This is Andy McLean, and this is my Coming to the Path talk. This is a redo of the first 5 minutes of this talk, which, due to technical difficulties, were missed. So, just going to try and recreate what happened there. So, first of all, I wanted to thank everybody for being here, and I wanted to say that I'm grateful to be here. I very easily could not be here. I could very well have been dead, killed myself through overdosing on drugs, which I did more than a few times during my career. And it is really, I have a lot of gratitude to be here today. Life today is, it's worth living. I wake up and am grateful to have one more day able to live. And I didn't always feel that way. So, thanks for being here. And as a little kid, my mom tells me these stories. We would go grocery shopping, me as a little toddler walking around, and she told me that as we would cross people, I would just say, hi there, to every single person I came across. It's funny to think about that. You know, how different was that? Just hi to everybody. Kind of cool. And the other thing I would do as a toddler is constantly ask the question, why? But why? But why? And it would drive my mom a little crazy, and definitely my mom's sister. Oh, she always tells me how I would just drive her nuts. But why? Why, Aunt Lois? Why? But why? So you can kind of see how I ended up here. I still question, why? Why? And, yeah, I think that's an essential part of why I'm here. I grew up in Rush, New York, which is south of Rochester here. Grew up in a big farmhouse. And my parents, I had two little brothers, and we were raised Christian, Presbyterian. And I was never fond of going to church every Sunday like we did. The best thing I liked about church was that they served donuts after every service. That was awesome. And other than that, I just I didn't feel it. Didn't get it, you know? Always, why? Why? Why this God? And why this Bible? Are you sure that's what God said? Why? And I guess the answers never really satisfied me. And I think that's one of the things I really love about Buddhism, and what attracted me to coming here, is that the answers aren't in a book. We find the answers inside ourselves, and we just have to use the tools to find those answers that are, you know, just deep within and based on our own personal experience. My parents were divorced when I was about 11. It was a pretty turbulent time for everybody. It gave me a huge amount of responsibility as a young kid. A lot of the daily pressures of, you know, it became mom's house, dad's house, and my little brothers always looked at me when there was a squabble about where do we go, where do we go, and, you know, it was kind of hectic, you know, back and forth, and I kind of showed a lot of responsibility of, you know, making sure things happened, and, you know, but things smoothed out, and, you know, it was all right, and it was still, you know, mom's house, dad's house, but we dealt with it. We made it work. I did have a best friend growing up, which is a huge blessing. Really great guy. Still is my best friend today. You know, did lots of kid things together, hung out outside, played lots of outdoor games, and shooting off model rockets and all kinds of kid stuff. It was nice having him. He lived not too far away, and he was pretty much my third brother. You know, if we weren't over at his house, he was over at our house like all the time. It was really great, and his dad was a really great influence on me, his work ethic and just the guy that he was, a really great role model. And so this is where we turn it over to the actual recording, so enjoy. A really great role model for me. So did we miss that whole beginning?
Yeah,
sorry
about that.
Okay, sorry. You want me to start over?
Why?
Yeah, exactly. Well, hell with it. I'm just going to keep going. So my best friend's dad, he was a really great role model. He was our soccer coach. Just a really great guy. And he was also one of the Boy Scout leaders. So me and my best friend, we were in Boy Scouts. And I really loved that. Really gave me a lot of good moral direction. Gave me stuff to do with other kids. Really taught me the value of working together as a team. And gave me the love of outdoors and travel and camping and big adventures. Took a couple really nice Adirondack canoeing trips, 7 days of canoeing through the Adirondacks with just what we could take with us in our pack and, you know, the dehydrated food. And it was awesome. It was so beautiful. And we also took a trip out west to a scout ranch in Cimarron, New Mexico called Philmont, where we spent about 10 days on the trail. Again, just what we could carry on our packs, hiking through the mountains. And, man, I really gained a sense of Mother Nature, and they always instilled us the sense of conservation of Mother Nature, taking care of her. And that's always stuck with me, always trying to leave a place better than I found it, trying to live at one with nature, and something that's stuck with me. And my best friend's dad was the first one who kind of got me into the Eastern thoughts. He was an Eastern religions teacher at a local high school in Rochester, and that's how I was introduced to the Tao Te Ching. I first read that probably when I was like, I don't know, 16. And something about that book just, I don't know, it was really hung with me. I still remember right now to this day reading, you know, the master does without doing. And I was like, wow, does without doing, huh? And I also read Siddhartha. I really, really, that was by Hermann Hesse, really loved that book. And somehow I got turned on to Carlos Castaneda's in there too. And or a whole ton of his books, and that really introduced me to, he would always talk about making his mind blank, dropping his thoughts, and this, I read that, and I said, oh, that's interesting, and I started really looking at my thoughts and noticing, wow, this is just a constant stream of thoughts, what the hell, how do you stop that? And I started noticing all of a sudden there's tiny little gaps, and if I concentrated on those gaps, they would get farther and farther apart, and I eventually got to the point where I could just, psh, boom, all right, drop my thoughts, boom. And they would never stay dropped, of course, and I would always try and really, come on. And I read some books on meditation and tried to do it, but no one told me you were supposed to sit on a cushion and get your hips higher, so I would sit and my back would kill after 10 minutes. I'm like, how do they do this stuff? Man. But I think that that practice of just dropping my thoughts, that was kind of like my first Zen practice, I guess. My best friend's dad also had his own above-ground pool business where for summers we would work all together, making money, doing pool work, and he would always tell us about his adventures when he was a kid. He hitchhiked cross-country like 3 times and went to Europe, all this stuff, and we kind of got that, oh man, adventure, let's do it. So we planned our first big trip. It was after my senior year of high school where we drove cross country. We worked pools all summer. His dad bought us, he bought a brand new van to do pools in. And instead he said, bought us, and here you guys go, take this cross country drive to California. And my best friend planned out this itinerary 2 weeks long, every single night where we'd stay, some little campground or wherever.
zipping across the country and back, you know, made it to California, Route 1 along the coast. I remember vividly driving that, just, man, just being inspired with awe and seeing the redwoods out there. Oh, my goodness. It was awesome. My first taste of real freedom and big adventure, and I was hooked. I loved it. I wanted to travel, just keep traveling. I remember on the drive back, we were about probably a day or day and a half from getting back to Rochester, and we just started talking about Europe, next summer, let's do Europe. And sure enough, next year, my buddy did a bunch of research, find out that in Europe, they have these international youth work programs, and signed us up for this place in Germany. And we got assigned to basically like a German national forest type place. Again, we worked doing pools all summer to raise money for our plane tickets over there. And it was a 3-week long adventure. There was about 17 other teenagers, age 16 to 18, just like us. And we worked and lived together for 3 weeks. We lived in tents outside. We had a cooking tent and two tents where there's cots set up. We took turns cooking meals every day. We'd all walk into town and get the food that we needed. And we just very quickly gelled, just became like a family. We just all really became like best friends so fast. It was just magical. We would just spend night after night sitting up, talking, and it was really cool how, and some of them barely spoke English, and that was became really exciting, is learning how to communicate with someone who barely can understand what you're saying, but you find a way. It's such a beautiful thing, and it was really great. It was so great that when we finally had to leave, we would all be sitting around the campground, and we would leave some little small waves of us that had to walk to town to catch the bus, and as every wave left, we all were bawling in tears, every single one of us, and every single wave, again, the flood of tears. It was that powerful. It was that awesome. It was like that. It's great. So I had the travel bug. I loved traveling. It was great, and I wanted to keep doing it. I did graduate high school. I went to Syracuse University, and again, at Syracuse, I kind of got this freedom to be away from any kind of authority, and I could do whatever I wanted, and I quickly found house partying and drinking, and my gosh, did I love it. That was so fun. I would still manage to get my schoolwork done, but I definitely did the bare minimum I had to do to get stuff done, and then most of the other time was occupied and hanging out, you know, wherever there was people drinking and having fun. That's what I wanted to do. And eventually, my sophomore year, I discovered marijuana. And I still remember that first time. It was in a room with a bunch of other guys, and the one guy was in a band, and he was a music major, and he had an electric guitar. He changed his strings, tuned it up, and jammed out for I don't even know how long. And I was high as hell, just on the sofa, just like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And I was hooked. I loved it. I wanted that feeling all the time. So my junior year, I was out living on my own with, I had a roommate, two roommates in my own apartment, and my other roommate, he was down with me. We liked to get high, and we smoked like daily. In order to support that habit, we'd provide other people the necessary services. And it was a great way to maintain that habit. And I really loved. My apartment was like the place, man. Everyone came to hang out, to score. And it was just like the center of all the action. It was awesome. I loved it. And I found out I wanted to feel good all the time. And, you know, I wouldn't always like go to class high, but sometimes, but you know, it was still, I guess that, I didn't want to feel bad, and, drugs gave me the way to feel good. And that was my answer very quickly, is if I want to feel good, I'm just going to go and get high. And that's how I coped with things. That's how I dealt with everything. I wasn't good at facing my emotions, or, you know, my relationships were okay, but a lot of the time my relationship was with the drug. And that's, as long as I had that, I was fine with everything else. Everything else just, oh, whatever, I can go get high. And my junior year for spring break, I went to the pot stoner's mecca called Amsterdam, spent a week there with my stepbrother, and that was just heaven. I was in heaven. I was convinced this is where I need to be forever, because this is legal here and everyone here doing it. And it was really fun, actually. It was a great city to wander around stoned in. And but I did come back and graduated college, and went on to a semester of grad school in Vermont. And And just after that, I took a seasonal job working on Montauk for a summer. And after that, I was sitting there collecting unemployment, wondering, what do I do next? What do I do next? And this next, I can't believe this happened. But sure enough, I found a job opening for Burger King in the airport in Amsterdam. And I was like, what? Back to heaven? No way. Come on, this is a joke. There's going to be a camera somewhere jumping out. Gotcha! But no, for real, I went to an interview. Before I knew it, I had my plane tickets in the mail. They deposited my first month's salary in my bank account before I even left so I could get where I needed to go. Flew me over there. I landed. A guy met me to take me in a taxi to the houseboat that they were giving me to live on for as long as I worked at Burger King for free. I was like, what is going on? What did I... Come on. But nope, it was real. And Burger King was the Whopper factory. It was tough. I worked really, really hard. And it's an interesting experience. I worked with a lot of different cultures of people. A lot of Afghani, Indian, Pakistani, Middle Eastern people from Europe, and I got along with them all. And that was really kind of what opened me to, they would work so hard, and all of their money they would send back home to their family, because they were so poor, and this is just what they did. I remember coming in for a shift, and there's Shafiq working, and I left, Shafiq's still working, and I would come back for my shift the next day, and there he is still working. I'm like, Shafiq, you're still here? He's like, oh, yes, sir. Damn, do you want a break? You want to sit down? He's like, no, if I sit down, I'm done. I got to keep going. And I knew, he's doing this for his family back home. Wow. Really opened my eyes to things, to how maybe other people live. But, you know, I would still work really hard, and then I would play hard or relax really hard. You know, I would always get done with work and boom, let's go and get high. Let's go hang out with people and just wander around. And being in Amsterdam, everything was there. And I'm not kidding you. My second day in Amsterdam, someone introduced me to the guy who could get me anything I wanted. And there's also two other American guys there working at the time, and we hung out a lot. And yeah, it was, again, the same old thing of me just wanting to feel good all the time. But I was able to work. And then when I was done with work, do what I wanted to do. And I thought that was okay. I thought, as long as I'm not hurting anybody, you know, I'm not causing any problems, I'm just living life very hedonistically, but whatever. Isn't this what we all do? This is normal, right? That's what I thought. And I thought that was an okay way to live. And maybe for a while it was, but now I see, no, it was pretty selfish of me to live like that. There's a lot more things going on than just what I want to do to feel good. But I worked for Burger King for over a year, and then decided, I mean, it was tough. It was hard work. It's long shifts, and just, it was insane. It was the busiest Burger King in the entire world. By volume, by size, by sales, everything. It was crazy. And after a year, I was like, okay, that was good. That was good. I'm done. I saved up a ton of cash, and I decided to take a big European vacation, because traveling, oh man, traveling's awesome. So my best friend lived in Italy at the time, from our trip to Germany. He loved Germany. He stayed in Germany, learned German, loved fell in love with Italy, moved to Italy, learned Italian. He's like, can speak three languages. So he lived in Italy in a town called Perugia. So I went down there, visited him for a couple weeks, went to Rome and to Florence, visited those cities for a little bit, which is pretty cool. Then I went to Prague, spent a week in Prague. I still think that's the most beautiful city in Europe. It's incredible. It's like a huge, beautiful labyrinth with lots of good beer and lots of good jazz. It was awesome. After that, I went to Barcelona for a few weeks and knew some people there, and another beautiful, great city. And made a trip up to San Sebastian on the northern coast of Spain for a few days. Just a little paradise town up there. It was great. After that, I went back to Amsterdam, and I knew some friends who had a small apartment, and I decided to, you know, stay in Amsterdam and see if I could make money playing my guitar on the street. Because in college, I fell in love with music and getting high, so I decided maybe I could play guitar myself, and I taught myself to play. And I wanted to see, because I would always see all these street performers around, and they always looked like they were doing all right. So I said, let's give it a shot. And at first, I just did it occasionally just to see, because I had some money. But slowly, the money ran out, and there was like about 10 or 11 of us living in a small apartment. And after a while, they had to leave the apartment because the guy was giving it to them, needed to move back in. So I found another place to live, and I lived in that other place. And I lived totally off what I could make on the street. You know, I was able to pay the rent there, able to eat every day, and have enough for a little bit of smoke every day. You know, that's exactly what I wanted. And there was something about that freedom that I totally loved. Something felt so natural about just living off the kindness of others, just playing my guitar out there. I had my own hours. I could do whatever I wanted. And I really felt pretty free and pretty natural. And I did that until it started to get cold out, and I couldn't really play because my fingers would lose their feeling. And I didn't really, I mean, I guess I still wonder if this was the dumbest decision I ever made, but I decided to come back home to Rochester, and apparently there's these student loans I had to pay back, and I figured I should probably start being responsible and paying those back. So I did. I came back home, living with my parents. Went back into the food service business again because I knew that business and I knew they didn't drug test, and most everyone there was into getting high too. That was pretty much the business, so I fit right in and I liked that. So that's what I did. I worked. I eventually moved out of my parents' house, had my own pad, and quickly my pad became just like it was back in college. There I was doing the same old stuff. Providing the services people needed, and liking that my apartment was the center of action. Everyone was always coming by, always wanted to hang out, and I liked that. I liked that I felt like I fit in there, you know. I felt like everything was going well. I always had what I needed, and I thought I was happy with that, but, you know, I think really as I was just avoiding the discontent I felt, because when I was getting high, that's what it was. It was just avoiding all these feelings, the stuff that I didn't want to see. But that's all I knew. And so I just kept doing it, and I kept doing it. And, you know, I would generally be able to pay all my bills all the time. Every once in a while, I'd have to call my parents, be like, oh, I need to borrow some money because, this and this happened, so I need to pay rent. And, you know, it wasn't that much, but it was enough here and there that I should have been like, oh, man, maybe I should take a look at this. But no, rationalization and denial is a pretty powerful thing. So I did that for a few years. After a while, I ran into a connection in Rochester where I could get some good cocaine, because I did that in Amsterdam sometimes. And I really liked the way that made me feel. And so I would start using that. And it was just occasional here and there. But, you know, it would still keep me up real late. And didn't really make me feel that great the next day. But I was willing to deal with that because it made me feel pretty good. And I really wanted to feel good. and that, experimenting, and I would experiment with cooking a little bit, and I really kind of liked the buzz that gave me. And my apartment being the place it was that dragged in all different kinds of those types of people, eventually this really beautiful young lady walked in my door, and I was really crazy about her. She liked to get high too, which I really liked. She knew how to smoke crack. She showed me how to smoke crack. She showed me where to get the good crack. And she was really into me, I thought. She really liked me. It was great because I had a place where she could come. I would feed her and we would hang out. I had money and we would always have a lot of fun together. And I didn't really understand that whole drug scene so well. So I just kind of thought, wow, this is really cool. This is really great. Someone I really can understand and get along with and have a good relationship with. And, you know, I've had relationships before and, you know, they were fun, but I don't know. Somehow I felt like they really didn't get me. And I really felt like I didn't belong in general. I mean, a lot of my early days in school, I kind of felt like I was always this nerdy, geeky kid that there was something wrong with. You know, the girls always wanted to be just my friend, and I always thought, well, that's just because I'm a short little geek, and there's obviously just something wrong with me, so obviously I'm inadequate, and so, of course, girls aren't going to really like me. But this one, she really liked me, and we really liked the same stuff, and this was really cool. And but not too long after that was going on, I kind of got the feeling that something's kind of weird. I mean, she was always disappearing, running off to the bathroom, and I just kept, huh, man, what is this? And one day I heard this tremendous crash and thud in my bathroom. I was like, what? What's that? And I was going to call her Q because I don't want to say and break anyone's anonymity, but just for the sake of easiness, Q was spread on the floor, completely sprawled out with a needle in her arm, and I was like, oh, damn. I went over and saw her lips were a little bit blue, and she wasn't breathing, and I knew CPR from Boy Scouts. I, you know, was a lifeguard back then, and I put my hand and I listened, and she had the very faintest of heartbeats. So, like, okay, all right, all right. I just started giving her breaths. That's all I knew to do. I was like, oh, I was a little, I don't know, surprisingly calm, but at the same time, what do I do? And I just, okay. After a couple minutes of that, she kind of came around. I ran and grabbed the phone and called the ambulance, and they came and picked her up, and there was something about that experience that just made me feel like I was kind of, she's supposed to be in my life for a reason. And it wasn't too long after that, there was a night we were hanging out together, and it's really hard to describe what happened here, but basically she kind of just looked at me and said, promise me, just promise me you'll never give up on me, because we had tried, it was after she OD'd, and we would try. I found out she was on heroin, and we would try endlessly to try and get her to quit, try and get her to quit, and she never could. And a couple months of that, and then it was after a couple months, one night she was like, just promise me you won't give up on me. And I don't know what it was about that, but it was just like something was calling to me to just stick it out with her, and then if I did, she would be able to quit this demon, because I saw it as a demon in her. And it was the stupidest thing, because here I was smoking crack with her all the time, and I kept thinking, well, if you could just smoke crack, then you'd be fine. It's the heroin that's killing you. Because there's nothing like seeing someone get sick from withdrawals on heroin. It is the most horrible thing you'll ever, ever see. They're puking. It was like the most gut-wrenching experience, and so I would do anything just to not let her get sick. And at the same time, you know, I felt, well, yeah, let's just get high on this, and then if you can quit that, everything will be fine, and we'll live happily ever after. And but I did promise her I would never leave her, or at least just not give up on her, and I stuck that through. And it took me to crazy places. And, you know, I really have to say that I was a lot... There's a lot of stupid stuff I did, and I would blame it on her, but really it was my fault. You know, I'm like, oh, man, it's all because of her that we're doing this and that. But it was, you know, I was... is equal to blame, because whenever she went to get high, I was like, well, since she's going to do it, I might as well too. And, you know, and I would just justify it. And then, you know, if she didn't do something that I liked or pissed me off, oh, I would go and get high over it because I didn't want to deal with it. And I suffered a lot of consequences from going down that road, because eventually I started snorting heroin too, just because I thought, well, maybe I can do it and stop doing it, and then she'll see, and then she'll stop doing it. Because I kind of thought I was invincible at that time. I had all this stuff under my belt, kind of felt like I was pretty much could do anything. And, yeah, I don't think that was quite accurate. So, let's see. Eventually, I did start injecting drugs too, and that's what led me to overdose, I don't know, several times. And even after those overdoses, I still thought, well, that's not, I didn't really understand the extent of it. Like, oh, whatever, I'm fine, let's go get high again, because damn. And I lost all kinds of, I lost my car, I lost my apartment, I lost jobs. I mean, I started doing all this stuff. I don't know, I stopped paying my bills so I get drugs. And I stopped showing up to work on time because we would have to go cop so she wouldn't get sick when I was at work. And I stopped even going to work sometimes because, like, I don't need the money today. I'll just go in and pretend I'm sick and leave and come home and we'll get high. And I started doing all this stuff, and I started scamming people. Stores, started scamming my parents. I started stealing from my parents and my brothers. They had collections of stuff at home that I would go through and take and pawn them off and sell them. And, you know, I would tell myself I'm doing it so she won't get sick, but at the same time, I was going and getting high with her, too. It's funny how I could rationalize that stuff. And eventually, we would get caught, and, you know, copping or something like that, but somehow we'd always get off. She was really good at crying, and somehow, I don't know, we got out of it. But one time, she was on her own, and she got caught, and she went to jail. And I bailed her out, and she wasn't going to go back, so she had a warrant out, and she said, well, let's go to Miami. And if we go to Miami, then we won't have the temptation of doing all the stuff around here, and then we can finally get clean and we'll be good. And I was like, oh, that sounds good to me. Yeah, so took a car, drove down to Miami, and guess what? It didn't work, because no matter where we went, there we still were. And we were still able to find all the stuff that we needed. And eventually, we got in trouble down there. She rear-ended a car and basically, instead of stopping, left the scene of an accident. And, of course, they caught us because the car was pretty messed up. We couldn't go very far. But she was like, oh, no, we're just, I'm like, dude, you need to pull over. She's like, no. Not gonna get caught. It's gonna be fine. But nope. So she ended up doing jail time, and I ended up having my dad drive down and pick me up and bring me back to North Carolina. And I lived there for a little while she did her time, and then she got extradited back to Rochester, and I moved back to Rochester so I could be with her and help her out there. And after that, she and I were clean for a while, and we were working at staying clean. And she was definitely working harder than I was, because I was still smoking weed, thinking, well, as long as I'm not using coke, then I'm good to go. And that was my justification, is as long as I'm just doing this, everything's fine. And, you know, I always liked to have that. I didn't run out of it very often. And if I did, I was always looking for more. So, I eventually ran into an old dealer, and before I knew it, the words are coming to mouth, yeah, let's go get high, and we went and got some stuff, and there I was, just like that, right where I left off. And I was probably hadn't used for about a year, well, coke anyway, and yeah, but I was using like, you know, every day, you know, like I would use for like a day or two, and then stop using for a week, maybe two, and then, boom, go back. And I kind of thought this was okay. I thought, well, as long as I'm not hurting anybody, as long as it's just every once in a while. And during that time, Q discovered someone at the Zen Center. She actually met someone out at Chapin Mill and went out to Chapin Mill and then signed up for a workshop here. And I dropped her off here, and I was like, what, a Zen Center? They do meditation there? I remember that stuff. I used to be kind of into that. I remember that used to be kind of interesting. And, my interest was piqued. And I picked her up, and she was just like, oh, man, this place is awesome. Oh, yeah, and she was just all into it. And I came back with her to Vesak, and when I came here, I just, this place had such an interesting, calm, magical feel to it. I had the sense that something was going on here that I needed to find out more about. And so I did. I went to my first workshop and went to the work retreat here, and I just really felt good, but not so good that I stopped using. I just would, you know, come in here and then still keep the, I would use every week or two. And I don't know. It's part of me wanted to stop, but part of me didn't, because that was the only real way I knew how to deal with stuff. And as soon as I stopped, stuff would come up, and I didn't know how to work through that. And eventually, one night, she called me one night when I was in my room by myself getting high, and she was like, are you okay? You sound funny. Are you getting high? I'm like, no, of course not. You're crazy. What are you talking about? So I was like, all right, whatever. And then she came over the next morning, and she just was like in the driveway. She's like, Andy, you were high last night. What are you talking about? She's like, no. And she like started crying. She's like, I know you. I know how you sound. You were totally messed up. And she was just bawling, and I was like, oh, no, busted. Damn it. And I said, yeah, you're right. You're right. I came clean. I've been using. I haven't really stopped. And she, just the way she was crying and just such despair. She's like, you put my life at risk. I mean, if I would have found out, and you could have ruined everything. And that was the first moment I realized that when I get high, I'm not just hurting myself. I'm hurting everyone who loves me, because I'm not there. I'm not present. I'm just with a drug. And that situation, it broke me. It broke me. I didn't want to use anymore. And she saved my life that day. She saved my life that day. Because after that, I knew, I can't keep doing this anymore. I can't. And I didn't want to, so I knew what I had to do. I knew I had to start going to 12-step meetings that I went to but didn't really get involved with. And I knew I had to come on staff here. I knew that if I came here, it would give me what I needed to structure my life in a spiritually sound way. And I did that. I did it. And I'm here today, alive and well, and thankful that I am here, and I have found a new way of life, a spiritual way of life, and I'm so grateful to share it all with you, that we can all walk on this road of self-discovery together. It's a beautiful thing. So there we go. Thank you. So now I guess if anyone has any questions, we do have some time. Man, I flew through this. I was all worried. I had so much stuff I had to cross out. And oh, boy, that could have gone on forever. And I was like, all right, man, beautiful. So anyone have any questions?
Yeah, I have a few. One is, so when you OD'd, what exactly did that mean? Were you with someone and you had to go to the hospital?
There was one time I OD'd when we were parked in a car, my car, and it was on a place by the railroad tracks, and we would often go cop and get high in the car, you know? And we did that, and I guess when you overdose, I did too much coke, and that just made me go into seizures. And I did that, and it just so happened that right when I did that, a cop came up to our car and was like, "What are you guys doing up here?" And I don't remember all this. I just remember there's an ambulance coming to pick me up and take me to the hospital, and I'm like, "What are you guys doing? I'm fine. No, I'm fine. Seriously, don't worry about it." But I mean, that's all that happened was they took me to the hospital. I got out of the hospital and they let me go. I didn't get any charges, nothing. And then other times I would OD because, yeah, I would find myself suddenly waking up on the floor with crap everywhere, like, what the hell just happened? And I was totally alone then and nobody knew. So that's how it happened the other times.
And what about just two more questions. One is, North Carolina, when you went back after Miami, did you suffer a lot of withdrawal? The other question was, when did Q start getting, when did she start doing the 12-step?
So I didn't use enough heroin to get withdrawals because I saw what happened to her. And I was like, there's no way in hell, no way I'm going to do it like that. So I just do it occasionally. And when we first started in Miami to try and get clean, I did experience a little bit of soreness, but nothing drastic. Nothing like I could have been like if I was really physically addicted to it. Mainly it was the mental obsession that drove me. And basically once I started to use coke, I couldn't stop. Like, it was that thing of once, that's the physical part of cocaine, is once I started using it, I didn't want to stop. And eventually I'd come to a point where I would, but usually it'd be after I was out of my money or after I couldn't find anybody to buy any more stuff from, then I'd be like, all right, that's it for this run, and then, okay, and then the next time. So that was, that's the physical part of that disease. But mostly it was the mental obsession to use and get high. Mostly I was just like, I want to feel good, so let me go and use, because that's what I knew to answer that question. How do you feel good? And I wanted to feel good as much as I could. And for Q, she first started working the program after she got caught. They assigned her to drug court, and so part of drug court meant you had to go to, she had to go to out service group, or outpatient services, like counseling. And they recommended her to go to meetings, and she would drag me to meetings with her, and that's when she first got into that. But then when she served her jail time, and after did that, she was in a halfway house, and that's when she really started getting serious and doing the work.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Andy, you spoke a lot about wanting to feel good, so I understand that. My question is, does Zen practice make you feel good?
Well, I wouldn't say the practice. It allows me to be open to whatever the moment is. So when things are going good, yes, I can feel good. And I don't need to cling on to that good feeling like I was. And when things are going crappy, I can just feel crappy today. Because a lot of what I was trying to do was not feel crappy either. And now today I know that feeling like crap, it's okay to feel like crap. Just feel like crap. And eventually it's going to pass. And just like when I feel good, I can just feel good because I'm having a good experience. And I don't need to hold on to that experience anymore like I would do. So Zen gives me the ability just to be in the moment and accept the moment for what it is. So I wouldn't say it makes me feel good. It just allows me to experience what's right there. I know Devin had a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the heroin addiction, the withdrawal, because I've heard that before. That's being sick on heroin just sounds so much worse than
brutal.
Other drugs.
It's brutal.
I wonder if you could describe that a little bit more, what you saw.
Well, I know that she would often be very itchy. She would say, and from other addicts too, just you would get this feeling in your joints of just, you couldn't get comfortable. Just every joint would ache. Your whole body would ache. And eventually you would just start vomiting uncontrollably. And that could last for days. And that feeling of just pain, joint pain, that could last for 2 or 3 days. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Ray. It's one of my favorite movies about Ray Charles. I'd highly recommend it. It shows a pretty good picture of what heroin withdrawal looks like. When he did it on his own, just locked himself in a room, I think. And I've heard of people doing that, and I think that's a way to do it. And it's, man, it's brutal.
Mm-hmm. Could you say something about the similarities and differences between the 12-step program and Zen practice?
Wow, they are so similar. It's really awesome. They both really deal with getting past the idea that we're in control of things. The first step is to accept, I'm powerless over my addiction. Basically, once I start using, I cannot control where I'm going to end up. And all the other steps, the first 3 steps are about just recognizing that I have the problem and that there is a solution. And the solution is basically coming to understand that my answers to what I thought life was are all wrong. I was all wrong. And then if I can see my life, I'll write it all out and see the patterns that I was doing, and then I can recognize my character defects. What would take me, because the problem wasn't really drugs, the problem was me. The drugs were just a symptom of my disease. I was basically a really self-centered, inconsiderate asshole, because I would do anything once I started going to get more. And I think the steps also give us the way to make amends for our mistakes, and then they give us a path of basically praying and meditating every day to recognize when we're starting on old destructive behaviors. And I think Zen practice is really the essential tool that allows me, because Zen practice is, first of all, focusing our attention, and then the mindfulness to notice when our attention is wandered. So I use that in my daily life to find, if I'm starting to get resentful towards somebody, if I'm starting to get lonely and starting to want to feel good and thinking I'm going to go out and use and that'll be a good thing, I have to have the mindfulness to recognize, oh, wait a second, that's not right. I'm acting out on old behaviors again. And it's that mindfulness that can catch me before I get too far acting out on some old stupid behaviors. And in Zen practice, really talks about compassion and how we have to have compassion for ourselves and for others. And even the Four Noble Truths, life is suffering, it's not satisfactory, and the cause of that unsatisfactoriness is our stuff, our self, our egoistic attachments to situations. Basically, I want what I want to feel good all the time, and I want to push away all the stuff that feels bad. And that's basically the nature of my disease right there. And then the way out of that is through basically living in the moment. And for me, my answer to that is living as a vehicle of service to other people. When I'm just being open to others' needs. And I think that's what, when you work a 12-step program too, they really emphasize the service part of it. Because when I'm being of service, it takes me out of my mind, my me, it makes me open to the bigger we. And they always say the 12 steps are a program of we. We can do this together because I can't do it alone. I couldn't get clean on my own. No way in hell. I needed the support of everybody in those rooms. And just like in Sesshin or in a meditation or anything, I can't do anything on my own. We're all connected in this together. And the more I'm aware and open to that, the more I can just be of service to that and let us all work through it together. So, how's that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, how are you getting along with your family these days?
Oh, it's my relationship with my family is way better than it ever was because now I can talk to my family on a deep level. I'm not constantly trying to, you know, be there, but not really be there. Like, my family, we never really talked about stuff growing up. We kind of just, it was really hard having the family split up like that. And we would never really talk about our emotions, talk about stuff. And today, I feel like I'm closer to all of them than I ever was because I was forced to basically come clean to them and tell them what I was going through. And we actually had to talk about stuff. And now I feel so grateful that they were there to support me the whole time. Like my mom, she was always there for me. When I was using her, manipulating her, she would always be like, oh, you need money? Okay, here you go. And I wouldn't have to explain too hard. And I'd call my dad for something. Oh, okay, sure thing, son. You need me to come pick you up in Miami? Oh, sure, I'll get you. No problem. You're my son. I love you. And my brothers, when I told them, oh, I stole all your stuff, they're hurt, but they're like, okay. And I was like, just what can I do to make it up to you? And I paid them back the money they wanted. I paid my mom back the money she wanted. And I did what they said is making amends. And by making these amends, it really kind of allows us to forgive and to move on. And I think that's one of the most valuable things I found is the ability to forgive. And number one, forgive myself, and then to forgive, and to have their forgiveness too. It's really opened the door for us to interact on a real level, and I'm really grateful for that.
And yeah, I still wonder about your transition. It sounded to me like from one day to the other, you stuck the tracks and came to the Zen Center.
Oh no! Oh no! Well, when I came to the Zen Center to move in here, that's when I stopped doing the drugs altogether. But when I first started coming here to come to my workshop, to go to the work retreat, and on my first two sesshins, I was still using occasionally. And then after that, once she busted me and called me out, and I just decided, oh damn, I can't keep doing this. I need to do something different. Then once I moved in here, I knew that was the line. That was it. I'm moving in here so I just made up my mind. That's it. No matter what, I'm not going to pick up anymore. And I did actually, after I moved in here, I smoked weed one more time over Christmas break when my little brother came home because that's what we did. And so technically that's the last time I ever used was December 27th, 2008. That was the last time I ever used. And so, but since then, yeah, I have, yeah, just green tea. And I guess that's okay.
Well, we have run out of time. Jonathan, looks like you have. Want to ask a question? This will be the last question.
Do you know yours is a common story that rock bottom has to be hit before the impetus for change is there. Do you think if you had been more actively exposed to Zen during your Amsterdam time, or that you know, somewhere in there that things would have, you would have listened to that before hitting rock bottom? Because as we know, a lot of people's rock bottom is a deadly overdose. And
yeah.
Your take on that.
I can't speculate on that. I have no idea. But I did hear something great about how do we know when we hit rock bottom? Someone out here, and they said, well, you've hit bottom when you want to stop digging. That's pretty much it. When I'm ready to stop digging, I've known that's my bottom. Because some people, they keep going through stuff after stuff after stuff, and it's really cunning, baffling, and powerful, this disease. It's really amazing how we can rationalize, and we know, and yet we still are just drawn by this habit force. It's really sad, and, you know, it's a miracle then people really come out of it. It really is. So I guess that's all our time. So thank you all very much.
I'm glad I checked the recording.
Well, people missed my little baby beginning. That's all right. Come ask me about it, I'll tell you.